So thanks all for joining. It's a real pleasure to be here today to start this session. I'm Gareth Price-Jones, the Executive Secretary of the Steering Committee for Humanitarian Response, a group of seven of the big NGOs and the two Red Cross organisations. Our goal today is to delve into the findings from the Interagency Humanitarian Evaluations, the IHEs for short, and to have a discussion about the successes and challenges of scaling up our collective humanitarian response complex humanitarian crises. These crises, as we all know, are often in contexts where access to populations, both to populations for us and for populations to access the assistance they need, is severely limited, funding falls short, conditions tied to funding are hard to meet, and development partners often withdraw. And increasingly often, some or all of those factors and indeed others. We're also finding increasingly that the humanitarian community is expected to fill gaps that would be better addressed through what I call the other complementary ecosystem. So we talk about our humanitarian ecosystem, but also the development ecosystem, the climate action ecosystem, the counter-terror ecosystem, even the ones we're less comfortable with, the political, diplomatic, and the military defense ecosystems. But it often feels like the nexus conversation is humanitarians talking to other humanitarians about what other people should do. So during today's session, we'll be learning from our collective recent experience in Afghanistan and Northern Ethiopia, as well as our wider learning about how we collectively scale up. No one found any of these responses easy. None of us is immune to criticism. And so I think it should be a really interesting conversation. So the lessons come from the evaluations commissioned by the IHE Steering Group, of which I'm a member, and I see other colleagues from that group here in the room. So thanks all for turning up. And they're an integral part of the collective humanitarian program cycle. So just as needs assessment, a strategic planning or resource mobilization are, learning from what we've done is equally critical. And in my role with the SCHR, I participate in a plethora of ISC bodies. So I join the EDGs, I sit on the principals. And so for me, and I think hopefully many of you, the IHEs are a really, really critical tool for all of us. And just to run through some of the things that I particularly value on them. First of all, they're incredibly robust. I've engaged with this group since 2019, and I've been consistently impressed by the technical knowledge and the thoroughness of the teams that we commission to put these things together. And it's great to have members from those teams in the room. Secondly, they're genuinely interagency and genuinely independent. So as NGOs in the Red Cross movement, we often get kind of accused of grumbling too much about the work that our UN colleagues do. Likewise, the UN often worries about our shortcomings as partners. And so I think having that independent voices that challenge us collectively is really, really useful. And I think the independence of the IHEs mean that we can be confident of an objective assessment. So although we govern the process as people who engage with those organizations, and we do push back a little bit on some of the more challenging findings, but it gives us something that helps us collectively learn without getting defensive, or at least without getting too defensive. And then finally, as evaluations that are focused on the interagency element of the response, they're by their very nature big picture. When we do our own individual organization evaluations, that's really useful and important, particularly when our organizations are big and they deliver to tens or hundreds of millions of people. But with the scale of need that we face at the moment, it's really important that the ecosystem as a whole, in all of its messy diversity, is able to really maximize its income and work as well together as it possibly can. It does mean we tend to be quite self-critical, which can be tough, but I think it's also the least that we owe to affected people. And it also helps us consistently as a humanitarian community communicate to those other ecosystems that I mentioned earlier. Just to wrap up, you should never underestimate the power of sharp lessons that are well documented, ideally in something that's short and easy to summarize so that busy people actually read it. And with that, I'm delighted to hand over to you, Juliet, and our other panelists.
Great, thank you very much, Gareth. My name's Juliet Parker, I'm the director at ALNAP. And it's my pleasure to be the chair of the session today. We are joined also by panelists online and also colleagues who are listening in on Zoom. Today, we're going to start with a brief presentation of the findings, then we'll have the opportunity to hear perspectives from our panelists, and then, of course, there'll be opportunity for question and answer at the end. And for those of you online, if you want to submit your questions on the Q&A, then we'll be keeping an eye on that as well. So, to introduce our presenters, we have Glyn Taylor, who's the founding partner of Humanitarian Outcomes and co-author of the learning paper on IASC system-wide scale-up mechanisms, who's going to present the key findings from protocol to reality, lessons for scaling up collective humanitarian response. And also Nicole Hentz, who's the evaluation manager who oversaw the IHE Afghanistan and Northern Ethiopia evaluations. So I'll hand over to you, Glyn.
Thank you very much. I believe I have 12 minutes. How well I do this depends on who wins the battle, caffeine or jet lag. So I'll give it my best shot. What we're going to do then is to canter through the key findings. It'll be a very short summary of the paper. It was a fascinating paper to work on, a really interesting exercise. Myself and my colleague Raphael, who I'll point to for difficult questions later. The idea, should we go to the first slide? Yeah, so understanding what we can learn. It was a relatively brief exercise we undertook. There was fantastic engagement, honestly, from the EDG. People were genuinely interested in the topic. So we did 63, I think, interviews in the end, and a brief document review. The idea was, next slide. The idea was to have a look at, rather than start from the protocols themselves and try to say how can we fix these, we set out to sort of have a look at to have open discussions with the with stakeholders and what's the reality of these instruments, what happens when the scale up is called, why do you use them, what are the key the key things for which you, what do you want to happen as a result of these scale ups. So if we start here on number four, this is a set of protocols established in protocols one and two, established in 2018. The idea of these was that they would replace the former L3 protocols, keep the good bits, and to tune out the pieces which were problematic. The pieces which were problematic included the fact that there were constant extensions of these the L3 status. It was difficult to turn them off, and the perception that these were a trigger for a request for funding. So the new protocols, looking at number one here, the idea was that this is much more focused on enhancing the operational capacity for response. So to get rid of the financial aspect to a certain extent, to get rid of the political component to a certain extent, but to make sure that these were about operational capacity. These are used in, looking at number two, the situations of sudden onset emergencies. It's much more obvious how this sort of scale up works in the natural, as with many of our tools and instruments, natural disaster, you need to scale up capacity easy. Not easy, but easier.
Less difficult.
But the protocols do allow for the use of these scale ups in situations which are, you know, very complex and very challenging, which we'll come back to. There is an emphasis on number three. There's an emphasis for the system wide protocols to focus on leadership and coordination, which is important. And it's important also to consider number five as well. And this is a theme that comes back throughout the paper, if you've read it, that what we're looking at is a system-wide scale-up, which coincides with the agencies declaring triggering their internal protocols, their internal scale-ups. So what we constantly found was, when we're talking to agencies, we did a mapping exercise. What was the coincidence between these system-wide scale-ups and the agencies triggering their own internal protocols. And what we saw was obviously a correlation, but not always. There wasn't an automatic link. The same with donors. When we talk to donors, they would say that, and we'll come back to this in terms of funding, that there is a that the protocol, the scale-up allowed them, the activation allowed them to try to leverage attention, but it was never the direct trigger for their changes in decision making. So everybody's very clear that they make pragmatic, evidenced, principled decisions, not to rely on a trigger. And some of them may have been telling the truth. Next slide. So, as I said, the way that we came at this was asking people principally what happens when what happens when you activate a scale up. We could also frame this because ultimately we decided after the first few conversations that we needed to break this down into stages: pre-activation, during activation, and then deactivation or kind of scaling down. So this is not simply four things that happen when the system activates a scale up, but the reasons why people wanted there to be a scale up in the first place, and what leverage were they trying to exercise? So mobilizing operational capacities is the obvious one. This is what the protocols are for. We need more capacity. The agencies need more capacity. There needs to be more attention, more focus, and the A teams. This is something we hear all the time. A teams and boots on the ground, this is what we need these things to trigger. But again, because the agencies are also launching their own protocols internally, we can't say that it's impossible to identify a causal connection that the interagency scale up, actually made these things happen. But that was very clear that was one intention. Instating or reinstating the humanitarian nature of the response. So we looked at Afghanistan, we looked at Ethiopia, we looked at Haiti, we looked at Somalia. And we allowed reflection on other contexts as well. Instances in which there's a long-standing sort of cyclical crisis, and the response was in a phase where it had moved towards the sort of transition, greater working alongside government, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly there's a trigger, there's a new conflict, a new context in which there needs to be a restatement of the independent nature, the principled nature of the humanitarian response. So in certain instances, this is the rationale behind that. We'll come on to signaling in a second. Strengthening the collective nature of the response. So this was clearly people identified this as something that happened when the system-wide protocol was activated. And that comes hand in hand with the tools, cluster, the setting of joint objectives, the benchmarking exercises. So for a short period of time, and the fact that these are all time limited comes back again. But for a short period of time as well, there is a refocusing on the collective nature and a strengthening of the cluster capacity, typically, and focus and leadership on the collective nature. Signaling is something we talk about a lot, and I'll leave that because we come on to the next slide. But the signaling the severity of a crisis, one of the things that we were supposed to be moving away from with this set of protocols, is still absolutely and clearly what people understand these protocols to be for, or why they continue to see these things, to want to see these things happen. Next slide, Mark. So we talk about signaling a lot in the paper. What do we mean by signaling? So pre-activation, particularly, signaling is the fact that people want these. They want the scale up to happen because they want to send a signal directly or indirectly to another member of the system, another stakeholder, to change their behavior. So some of these signals are quite direct. in the sense that one actor needs to see another actor change their behavior. And that includes signaling to donors that this is, an important crisis. Some of these signals are much less direct, in the sense that there is, in some instances, and this came out in Ethiopia, it came out in Haiti, this big signal that something needs to happen, that we that there is the fact that the UN, the ERC, is stating the severity of this crisis, that it will bring about some sort of change in the political bodies in the UN, the government itself, that it can solve higher level problems, or it can be very specific. And we come back time and time again to this question of donors. There is an understanding amongst actors in the system that scale up should or would lead to additional funding. We didn't really try to track that because we realized that even if we saw an increase in funding, we could only see correlation, not causality. Because again, donors state that they make decisions independently. This launches a, the launches a flash appeal, but some flash appeals don't come with scale-ups and vice versa. But there is an understanding or an expectation that activations bring more money. One of the really fascinating things that I found undertaking this process, we talked to a lot of donors. It comes up in certain countries that field level donor representatives advocate for scale-ups to send messages to their own headquarters to try to leverage more funding. Donors who are big donors in a particular context want this as a signal to other donors to increase their burden share. And in one instance, a relatively small donor who knew that it would have no impact on their capital recognized that there was underfunding in general, and therefore advocated for this to send a message to other donors that they should participate, even though they knew that their own headquarters could not couldn't do that. So it was a really interesting set of discussions. But typically, and perhaps the most obviously, this is non-UN actors, NGOs, basically saying that the system, the clusters, the UN, be it at the national level or in certain areas of the country, need to strengthen their response. And therefore, we want to see we want to see a change there. Deactivation continues to be universally problematic. So what we generally found was nothing has changed at all. Once you get to the end of the scale up, it is fairly clear that the energy boost, we talked about this as sort of turbocharging effect, runs out after 3 to 6 months. But even so, nobody is typically willing to turn the activation off for fear of sending the signal that this crisis is suddenly less important. And it doesn't matter whether or not, if you look at Afghanistan, Afghanistan was seen as a generally successful scale-up, but in the sense that the interests of Western donors and agencies aligned. The question of whether or not the scale-up was necessary or would these same effects have happened is an interesting question that we couldn't answer. But when it came to the end, we spoke to actors in Afghanistan. They realized that they'd had a massive amount of media attention. They had then been usurped in this imaginary league table by Ukraine. And people stated, we don't want to slip down that table. So we can't turn off, and we can't turn off the activation, even though we recognize that it's no longer giving us any additional value. Ethiopia is the opposite. Did it achieve much? Not really. Didn't solve the problems that we had in terms of Ed's here somewhere, access and accountability. But it would be the send the wrong message to say that this is suddenly now less important. Next slide. How am I doing for time?
You're up 6 months.
Excellent.
So good.
So what actually happened? What did these achieve? I'm going to actually come to or talk to a point which is on the next slide. The practical outcomes of the scale up in the focus countries we looked at were variable. In almost every context, people found some value in the scale up. So whether or not it was timely. So in Haiti, there was a lot of discussion around the scale up. Should it happen? Should it be partial? Should it be full? And would it actually make any difference? Ultimately, this decision was made. And generally, with hindsight, people said, look, it took us a while to figure out what really needed to change and where and how, but the value did come in terms of certain strengthening in certain areas. In Ethiopia, and we'll hear from the team that did the actual evaluation. What we heard in our interviews was that sure, there was a recognition going in that scaling up operational capacity was much less important than changing the access was the main problem. So a lot of surge capacity was stuck in the capital, didn't necessarily make a huge difference, to the sort of to the operational capacity. Afghanistan and Somalia, generally, quite favorable outcomes were seen as having come from the scale-ups. What they didn't necessarily do was to push at the subnational level to push this additional capacity, down onto the ground. What scale-ups do in practice is they bring this sort of set of tools and enhancements. The EDG visits, which were part of the process of decision-making or shortly afterwards around scale-up, were seen as really important and really, moments of really key moments of reflection. Benchmarking exercises is this idea then of the agencies collaborating, coming up with joint priorities at the start of a scale-up. What needs to change exactly and how. And some of these were extremely well done. Somalia was one. These were detailed, they were time-bound. Who needs to do what? What are we trying to change? And when does it need to change by and who needs to do it? Less so, much less so in other countries. A lot of inconsistency around the use of that tool. People tended to look back to the last benchmarking exercise in country or ask for an email copy from somebody else rather than having a consistent notion of how this ought to be done. And then we have the OPR, the operational peer review mechanism, which then comes in as part of this process, but it's very much somehow seen as an independent exercise and not referring to the scale up. Which would seem to be useful, but it's certainly not the case. Each one of these scale-up exercises is supposed to finish with a transition plan. How do we practically transition out of this back to the normal cycle? How do we manage the transition from this scaled-up collective entity back to business as usual? That was not done in any single country. Even though it's clearly in the protocols, there was no transition plans that we saw. Next slide. So what do we see? So these are examples of what the scale ups achieve and what they don't achieve. So again, they are not automatic triggers for external funding. There is no correlation that we could see. As I said, we didn't look very hard, but from the interviews that we did, there's still a strong perception that if you scale up because you need more money, there's no evidence that they made a significant difference in terms of donor reactions, even though they're used by donors to send messages to themselves and to other donors. No evidence that these make a huge difference. They also don't change systemic weaknesses or contextual challenges. So as we saw in the case of Ethiopia, the fact that the key problem is access. The key problem is political. It is legitimate to use the scale up under those circumstances, but ultimately the fact that there is greater attention and greater capacity does not necessarily change the situation on the ground. They do not overcome systemic weaknesses. I'll give you three examples of this, which I found this fascinating. Especially in Haiti, you have this the scale up saying send more people, deploy, deploy, deploy. At the same time, this DSS is saying get your people out of the country. So scale up, but you have to be able to leave on one plane. And so there's no, these don't override, the other parts of the system. We can also see where there is the need for, quite often the signaling was for hey, typically UN, you need a change in leadership. You need someone more suited to this context. The fact that there's a scale up doesn't make it any easier within the internal management of protocols. Even though these messages come from the EDG, there isn't suddenly a line of accountability to the EDG, that enables, greater sort of leverage on these things. There was one more. Yes, so certain, put this politely or not, certain secretariat bodies are slightly inflexible. And the fact that you have a scale up does not lead to greater flexibility of these entities. And we had some quite open discussions about DSS as well. Even though you scale up capacity and you get coordination capacity and operational capacity below at subnational level, there isn't DSS doesn't have the flexibility to match that, to match that capacity in such a way that it facilitates access at the subnational level. Last slide then. So looking forward to areas for reflection, and I think if there's one piece of the paper it's worth, no, read the summary. We looked at a certain, as I said, this was a very, we were discussing this earlier, it was an interesting exercise. It was short, it wasn't an evaluation, it was a learning paper, and I think it was the better for that. We a long piece on managing the signaling function. How do you get rid of this, the use of these protocols as a signal? There's nothing that we could come up with that hadn't been discussed before in the EDG about this specific problem. The best we could come up with collectively was the group was having, announcing on the day of activation, the day on which you would deactivate. And saying, that this is a time limited, a time limited exercise. It's turning on now, and it's turning off in 3 months' time, and that's it. Rather than recommendations, I think we talked about acknowledging with the EDG what these scale. Just look at the evidence that we've gathered. This is what the scale ups are in practice. So work from there rather than work from the protocol, and try to come up with a set of changes. The implications of simultaneous activations was a fascinating one. These protocols have been activated 11 times since 2018, and at the time we did the exercise, there were between five and seven simultaneous, well beyond what was imagined when the tool was created. But still, there was a queue. I really do mean this is a queue of countries trying to get. Or seeking the status of scale up, but for the for all of the reasons that it signals, the need for greater attention and funding, et cetera. But ultimately, we could not say, I think the problem start with the deactivation rather than trying to limit the number of new activations. Because at the time we were discussing whether Sudan ought to be a scale up or not. And then managing the transition, there needs to be or there could be a better use of these the collective tools to sort of manage the way in and out of scale up, in a much more sort of managed and strategic way. How was that, Tobin's?
A little longer, but very fascinating.
Hey, for caffeine at one.
Great, thank you very much. We're just going to hear a few words from Nicole, who on the Afghanistan and Ethiopia IHEs as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. So this is very difficult in 2 minutes and one slide to do any justice to the complex responses that were ongoing and are still ongoing in Northern Ethiopia and Afghanistan, nor will this 1 minute do any justice to the evaluations that have occurred, the interagency humanitarian evaluations of these crises. So this is just really a very, very brief snapshot to complement what Glenn has talked about. These two evaluations will be upcoming this month, so I would encourage you to go and look for them and seek them out and attend future briefings that we are going to do about them. So these are some common messages that really relate to the system from both evaluations. So immediate and short-term needs were largely met in Afghanistan throughout 2023. And the scale-up activation, as Glenn mentioned, contributed to this. This was less so the case in Ethiopia. Glenn also mentioned this. Communities really said that the aid they received helped them, but it was too late and it was often too little. So the scale-up was indeed, the evaluation confirms this, not enough to overcome the challenges that this response faced. And there were multiple. So as a collective, the two responses really found it hard to shift gears fast enough towards orientation of the new sets of needs or the new context that was presented. This partly resulted in uneven responses or in a feeling that it's simply not fast enough. It speaks a little bit to the flexibility and the agility of the system. With regards to the divisions in humanitarian country teams, here the two evaluations found different results. In Afghanistan, the HCT early on really came together to find solutions to the problems, and there were solutions found that they were really unusual, from flying in large sums of cash in airplanes to help everybody to be able to operate. But then there come moments where different opinions kind of create confusion and a deadlock. And in Afghanistan, this was largely related to reactions to the bans of female aid workers coming to work. In Ethiopia, there were disagreements about how to approach the response from day one, really. And this has really made the HCT, the humanitarian country team, which is the body leading the response, dysfunctional. I think they've really not been able to support the response in a way they should. And what we found also in both evaluations, and not only these two, in kind of any interagency humanitarian evaluations we do, preparedness is really hard. It's really hard to do. It's really hard to have the time. It's really hard to get it right, especially in situations where the context that we want to discuss or the scenario that we must prepare for is really politically unfavorable. You get no support to actually plan for it. You will have issues if people find out that you're planning for certain scenarios because, like, yeah, it's just not done. So, and that obviously slows down the response when we expect speed and ability to react quickly. Well, we didn't think it through before, so it turns out to be slower than expected. So preparedness is really a difficult one that we find always across evaluations. And as I said, there are many, many more things to say about these evaluations, but these are just some few points to contribute to the discussion.
Great. Thank you very much. First of all, I do want to acknowledge and apologize to everybody in the room about the warmth in here. For those online, we've got a very small room with quite a lot of people in, and particularly, sorry, the ones that are sitting on the floor, I do apologize. There is one chair at the front if anyone wants to fight over it. Yep, there's 1, 2, 3 chairs available for those that want to. But yes, I'm sorry. It's a bit cozy. Also, just as a reminder, the Scaling Up Response report is publicly available already, and I do recommend you read it. The way it's set out, the intention of the mechanism and the practical realities is really clear and gives a very clear picture of what the system is actually grappling with. And the IHE reports on Afghanistan and Northern Ethiopia, as Nicole said, will be available within the next month. The clarity and importance of the findings in those evaluations, I think, makes them also a very important read. So to please keep an eye out for those when they come. So in terms of what we're discussing today, so today we'll be looking at what we've learned from scaling up humanitarian responses, given the background of eroding humanitarian space and the politicization of aid, the funding crisis and overwhelming needs in multiple crises ongoing simultaneously, Ukraine, Sudan, Gaza, to name just a few. The responsibility on us, as we consider the findings from these reports, is what can be learned together as a sector to improve the delivery of aid for next time in order to better support affected populations. And in order to do that, I'm delighted to introduce our four panelists who are joining us today. First of all, we have Daniel Endres, who I understand describes himself as a retiree this morning, but most recently was HC for AI for Afghanistan and as regional humanitarian coordinator for the Horn of Africa. Also, we have Gabriella Wyman joining us online. Gabriella is Save the Children's Global Humanitarian Director, a member of the Emergency Directors Group. We have Hiwoti Simichu also joining us online. He works as the Deputy Country Director at Plan International in Ethiopia. And also beside me, we have Juan Soponpanic, who is the Global Camp Coordination and Camp Management Cluster Coordinator. That's a lot of C's.
Yes.
With the IOM in Geneva. Thank you very much to all the panelists for joining us today. So for my first round of questions, really what we're interested to hear is from the findings of the presentations, what is it that resonates with your experiences of scaling up in humanitarian responses? And what are your perspectives on the lessons and findings raised? Maybe Daniel, I can pass to you first.
Thank you. Well, thank you for inviting me and for, I think, what is a very great start of the session. The learning paper on the scaling up in complex emergencies, I think, is really resonated very well with what I lived through and what I experienced. I was not the humanitarian coordinator in Ethiopia, but as you know, there was an additional role created because of the challenges that existed. So that was this regional humanitarian coordinator. My function was a lot to shuttle up and down between Mekele and Addis, and hopefully to lessen the divisions, which I think we don't pay enough attention to. It's good that you all mentioned it, but the divisions in Ethiopia were absolutely stark. And that paralyzed to a large extent also the humanitarian country team. And it was difficult to find any form of direction on how humanitarian action should happen. So that's just one example. Also in Ethiopia, when we extended the scale up for another 6 months, not three, that was exactly in autumn, just after the expulsions, the PNGs, and it was the worst moment in terms of relations between the UN and the Ethiopian government. Many people couldn't come in, didn't get the visa, and if they were in country, they couldn't go to the field. And we had very limited access. So gearing up in a situation where you're so cobbled made, in fact, no sense. But then to say we deactivate would send the wrong signal. Mm-hmm. So this was very much a huge discussion we had. And indeed, all the donor representatives were there, the most forceful in asking for extension. Mm-hmm. A lot of work went into relationship building also with the Ethiopian government, and we were able to have visas, we were able to deploy. So that's exactly when the second extension happened, and the yeah this the second extension for another 6 months, and that's the moment when Ukraine blew up. So the just to show what I think what I want you to say is, you said it, you know, this scale up, I think, is a good tool. It is helpful, especially if it's managed internally. But we cannot be one size fits all these protocols. But it's very clear it the context on the ground has to have precedent over what looks then often as very unsuitable rules. So the what I would what you know we need to focus on the delivery, and make that the measure of our work. What can we do on the ground, and then see how the protocols can actually support that meaningfully. I think I read that, or maybe I wanted to read that out of your learning paper, but that was important. You said the context on the ground should be our main learning, and I think that was very helpful. Now, the four key functions, the interlinked, should be interlinked and interdependent. That's what you mentioned, you know, the operational capacity gear up, the reinstatement of humanitarian or instatement of humanitarian nature of the operation. It's too often also in Ethiopia, you know, it was we were still many mechanisms were still from the development world. So the DO was a development person. So and so it was not only a political division, it was also that division on how you should work between, you know, the more peaceful development actors that wanted to evacuate as the Tigrayans were coming towards Addis. And in this moment, the ERC, Martin Griffiths, was there. He said, yeah, maybe you evacuate. We, of course, do the opposite. We will come in as the humanitarians. So, you know, all this is to say it's not easy to reinstate the humanitarian, and then the collective response. I think this is the most difficult. And I think if we talk about 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 72 months, which Syria was under the L3, we need to have the possibility to respond collectively, be it because of development, humanitarian, political divisions, whatever it is. Until we have that, we are not able to deliver properly. So in many ways, we should be a bit less constringent with the time boundedness, or we've defined it as a very minimalistic internal gear up that we have to discuss. And then, of course, signaling, I think that's the most important, because the signaling is also, you know, the challenge is, of course, Ethiopia was not happy when we extended the scaling up. But if it's an internal measure, why should they even know? You know, so this is also, of course, the protocol says we have to say. But these are the questions. I don't know time-wise if I should continue or should hash over. I have many more points, but there will be a second round. Maybe just on fundraising, and then I mentioned already the transition and ending the 6+3 that fits for natural disaster and sudden onset disasters. If you look at all the complex emergencies that you look at, they are between 14 and 30 months. So I think we also need to be a bit realistic. If you say it should be 6 months and that's it, and it never happens, then maybe we should reality catch up with a rule, or have a transition. I think that is also a good idea that keeps the signaling effect on, at least. And then the fundraising. Look, if you have a significant new emergency, and you know the way it's described, the way we define it, of course, you need to mobilize resources. I think what we don't want is, oh, we are underfunded, let's go for scaling up. But the resource mobilization is an absolutely, it's on day five that you should have your flash appeal. Good luck for that. And it is important. Many actors they need money to actually deploy, especially NGOs. They were not able to mobilize if the donors were not part of it. So I think, and you said in your paper, it is a contradiction, but I think we need to recognize mobilization of resources is key. Maybe just one point here on the collective response on how to overcome divisions and bring people more together. I'll talk to that hopefully in the second round again. But what I really saw as turning points was in the ERC visit. So Martin Griffiths, when he came, he magically pulled the extreme positions together by also challenging them. And the most helpful, I think, was the role of the EDGs, which were like a co-lead in this. And we had lots of conference calls. Many thanks for that as well. But that's my first round. So
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So signaling and deactivation coming up again as very strong themes, but also the importance of the collective response. And you mentioned the role of the EDGs. Maybe we can pass to Gabriella next and get some perspectives from you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And similar to Daniel, I mean, there's a lot I recognize in what the non-evaluation brought forward. The most important one, indeed, being the signaling function, which it is exactly not meant to do, but how it is mostly used. I think that's really a key point, and that brings with it what Daniel also mentioned, the signaling of a potential deactivation, right? And that after X number of months, the crisis is still raging equally badly. We haven't managed to scale up. So on what basis do we then deactivate the scale up? But if we don't, that then begs the question, what is then actually an L3? And this is, I think, something that that we're all struggling with. You know, I kind of remember the days when the L3 system was being put in place, and the EDG at the time wanted to put in place a system that would allow for three simultaneous L3s. And that was sort of like the worst case scenario, right? That was something that the system needed to collectively be able to manage, three simultaneous L3s. At the moment, we're probably dealing with eight. So that means that the signaling becomes, there's a decreasing return on investment almost on the signal, right? It's like, and so we dealt with the same problem internally in Save the Children. We had something called Cat One. So Cat One was sort of like the big word, you know, Category One emergency. That was when the whole sort of like Save the Children movement would, sit up straight, going like, oh, that's the signal to drop whatever we're doing, to, you know, reprioritize internally, make money available, make people available, and scale up. But if you have one Cat One and then a second Cat One and then a third Cat One and then a fourth Cat One, that signal starts losing its meaning. Yeah. And similarly, those Cat Ones didn't diminish. So how do you then start standing things down? But that then diminishes the overall meaning of what, you know, a scale up, what does a big emergency then mean? So internally, in Save the Children, we changed the system and said, let's just recognize that we are currently dealing collectively as a sector with about eight massive emergencies. But let's use a different system, which is to prioritize, which is an internal system that says, but in this particular crisis, our operation is not up to scale. It's not where it should be. So it's a little bit an internal measure that says, you know, let's put some resources here to get us where we need to be. This is kind of what we're discussing here, right? Is you know, what is the scale up meant to do? Is it an internal system that donors should not be made aware of because it's just basically getting our house in order? Or is it a signaling? And we continue to remain confused about that. So that for me is the biggest recognition. It was the problem during the L3. It was what the scale-up were meant to fix, right? To move from the L3 to the scale-up, it was meant to fix this signaling system. It didn't. So maybe we just need to acknowledge that we need, as a sector, a signaling system to say, help, help, really, really big crisis here, and we're not meeting the needs. And therefore, that signaling is actually really, really important. That brings me to the point of what was discussed a little bit earlier on this sort of mutual accountability. I see it as sort of like a triangular accountability. We, as the international humanitarian system, we are responsible for the operational scale up. So provided that we're given the access and provided that we have the money, we can scale up. But there is an accountability there with the member state that has requested the international assistance to support access, and with the donors to provide the funding. There's it's not really realistic to assume that we can scale up if we don't have money and if we don't have access, right? But we don't call that out, because as a system, we have been conditioned for our fundraising capability to always say, we've got it, we're on it, we're scaling up, or you might have access problems, but we don't, right? So we're competing with each other, and that's our way to fundraise. And we have never collectively, until the crisis at the moment in Gaza, we have never collectively said, we are not on it, we don't have this, the conditions for humanitarian assistance are not there. And we are signaling to the international community, to the political part of the house, to the diplomatic part of the house, that we have not got this one. So if you, as political leaders, as member states of the United Nations, want us to help fix this, you have a responsibility. You have a responsibility in the political arena. You have a responsibility increasingly in the legal arena, because not only is our access being curtailed in terms of actual physical access, we are increasingly being curtailed on the legal front. And those are arenas that we have basically been blindsided by as a community. We haven't played in those arenas. So counterterrorism legislation has really tied our hands behind our back as a community. And increasingly, right now you see the big debates on international humanitarian law, right? We are increasingly have our hands tied behind our back in the legal arena, while we are trying to perfect our operational ability to meet the new requirements in those legal arenas. So we need to start learning to play in different arenas, because we're kind of missing the boat here. I think my last point I would make is more a reflection on, for us as an EDG, or certainly for myself as a member of the EDG. I think, if I speak for myself, have underestimated the importance of the EDG visits. It was mentioned here today that it is something that actually spurs something on. I always felt a bit shy about them. I thought, oh my God, all of us coming, it's a lot of work for the receiving country team. Is it sort of like worth the while? And what I take away from this discussion is that it does have actually a really important function. So I think we need to reflect a little bit on that. We've been definitely shy about it, knowing that it does come with a lot of work for people that are also trying to respond at the same time. I think I will leave it at that, and then we can go into the further discussions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you also particularly for bringing up the, as you're talking about, the triangle of mutual accountability, which came up as a theme in all three of the reports, but particularly with the recommendations around this in the Ethiopia paper, which I thought were extremely interesting. Maybe we can move on to Hawati. Just before we do, just the good news is they're sorting the AC. So for those in the room, hold on. We'll be feeling a bit better soon. Hawati, maybe I can pass to you.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Julia, for inviting me for this session. I think Daniel is also creating a difficult time for me to express my feelings, being that he's adequately just representing. Before jumping to reflect my observation as a humanitarian actor operating in Ethiopia, I would like also just to recognize the effort and the ability of all humanitarian actors to try to respond for the different crises that we have in the country. As I always clearly just highlighted, Ethiopia is a very different and very complex country. It's not only dealing one type of crisis, but we are experiencing with a multiple and overlapping crisis where humanitarian actors is expected to respond for more than three type of crisis at a time. So it gives a clear testimony how the humanitarian actor is stretching in a different crisis that we have. Having said that, in terms of looking the northern crisis that we experienced for the last couple of years in the northern part of the country, one of the biggest issue that I would like to just highlight is related to the lack of preparedness. Looking the triggers and the signal that we observed between the friction of the TPLF and the federal government, it emanated like in 1918 and 1919, and that also just pushing the conflict party to broke out that conflict. From that perspective, the humanitarian actor is not adequate enough in terms of monitoring the situation, analyzing the overall landscapes and preparing for the worst case scenario, because we know it's very well, this conflict will broke out between the federal government and the TPLF. It's just a matter of time. And as Plan International, we develop that clear scenario and we try to just prepare for the response before the crisis. So in terms of looking the totality, what we really just like is to put in place the right tool and system to monitor the situation and to predict the likelihood scenario of this conflict and preparing for the response. In that perspective, we feel that there is a missed opportunity, like in terms of be prepared and responding to the crisis. So I think that is the biggest gap that we observed in the overall operation of the Northern crisis. That is also just clearly just came out in the evaluation process. The second point that I would like to just reflect is the lack of collective and decisive leadership, not only just looking the HCT, but in terms of also just looking the totality. I think there's lots of fragmentation. And there is no anyone who is just taking that initiatives in terms of tackling that fragmentation and bringing all the different actors together to really interface the humanitarian crisis, but also just putting lots of pressure on the government to secure access and to respond for the people of concern. So that lack of leadership, this fragmentation, is really just observed in the entire period of the crisis. And during the scale-up, it is really just difficult to see in terms of moving forward the systems and the processes is put in place in terms of responding for that. So that lack of coordination and decisive leadership is one of the biggest observation that we had. The other point is related to the signaling. Signaling is also just perceived positively from the humanitarian actor side, being that is also just a means to increase the operational capacity in terms of signaling the situation to the donors to ensure that funding at scale. But that signaling is also just bringing lots of challenge from the government side, because that operation is highly politicized and the government is totally feeling unhappy and creating lots of problems. As clearly just highlighted by Daniel, is issues related to the siege, issues related to the denial of access and giving the visa permission for the surge capacity. That is the biggest challenge that we face from the government side. But no one is just very strong in terms of standing in front of the government and challenging the government to get the unhindered humanitarian access and scaling up the response during that critical time. The other point is related to funding at the scale. Yes, it is quite related to the level of preparedness, but right after the system-wide scale-up, funding is not at scale because the magnitude of the crisis is huge. Yes, access is also just another challenge. But in terms of really just knocking the donors to increase their funding is not just matching with the needs on the ground. And we heavily just criticized by the government and the community. And that's why sometimes the humanitarian response is perceived wrongly by the government and by the community. So that is the biggest challenge that we face. And there is also just a very paradox thing, particularly looking after the TPLF recapturing Mekelle and try to just advance that conflict to Amhara and Afar. There is like a very different discourse that's happening in the country. One, there is like the relocation and evacuation of staff, scale downing of the operation related to development. In other side, there's also just an effort in terms of looking to scale up the humanitarian response. So that is creating a big vacuum in between humanitarian and development. That is a big missed opportunities that we had in terms of really just bringing humanitarian ways with development to look from the durable and the nexus principle from the start of the very big beginning. And humanitarian actors struggling to be in, while development actor is also just suspending their operation, evacuating from their country, that also just compromising the collective ability and capacity to respond for the crisis to the required scale. So those are some of the observation that I would like to just add, on top of what Daniel is clearly just mentioning about the overall humanitarian response, some of the challenges in relation to the system-wide scale-up that we impacted in the northern Ethiopia. Over to you, Julia.
Great, thank you very much. With the panelists' permissions, after we've heard from one, I'll open it up to questions. Because there's been an awful lot of content so far, and I think if I was in the audience, I'd be itching to have something to say. But one, before we do, maybe I can pass over to you. Thank you very much. I will be brief. I mean, I admit that, you know, when faced with usually the IHU report, I tend to just go in and look for whether my cluster is mentioned. And whether there was any criticism or we did well. So I found the learning paper also is a really good opportunity to just take a step back and then not like looking at this from where my part in the scale up or my part in setting up and contributing to the response. I think Iwuatu was mentioning relationship with the government, which I find that this is something. So I co-lead the global cluster for camp coordination and camp management. And I think we have some parallel struggles in that, in a way, it's an area of work that is kind of logical, it's common sense, but at the same time, it's introducing a foreign concept into the working of the day-to-day of whether it's a local or national authorities. And I feel often that, you know, the perception, I think we talk about signaling, but I think often also like the perception of the government as well on what is happening and what is being announced and what different agencies or UN agencies are saying also impact, you know, the reception that we get in a way as we go in to try and set up. I was also in Tigray to set up our CCCM cluster as well. So I was fortunate enough to lead the shelter cluster before the Tigray crisis. So I've had a chance to form some relationship with a number of NDRMC, our government colleagues before crisis happened. And I think those are some of the really valuable
relationship and preparedness action, what he was talking about, preparedness in terms of, you know, operational preparedness, I think coordination and different mechanism that we walk into when we enter these countries and we declare a scale up, we declare an activation of the clusters. I think the amount of work that we can do ahead of time can really pave the way in understanding roles and responsibilities. I think we have done, and I don't know whether this can be a study to see whether the government and countries where we work in a lot around preparedness in humanitarian coordination and response, there's less scale up being done there at the moment. I think as government take on leadership around coordination, it then become us who have to adapt and work to their system and their mechanism. One of our challenge also is that we don't have a camp like line ministry, because, you know, why would you need it on your day-to-day governing of a country? So in early day of most large-scale responses, we go in and we're trying to find a counterpart. So while all of this is going on, you know, movement of people in and out, evacuation of staff going, you know, search colleagues coming in, we're there trying to find, like, can we have someone who can talk with us and work with us in this areas that, you know, that we're always there to advocate for. At the same time, I think it's what really resonates as well from the report is, the learning paper and the report also is this transition discussion. In camp management practice, we always say, you know, camp should be the last resort. If there's going to be a camp, you should be talking about how you're going to close a camp at the same time as you're setting it up. But reality is you're either doing that in the preparedness, you know, out of crisis time, or once you're in there, and I'm in our global support team. By the time transition happened, I'm talking about another crisis, you know, or when we had like five ongoing at the same time. It's really hard to keep the same kind of attention on during transition phase as well. So I feel that in our work, for example, for displacement, we find that the best time to talk about durable solutions is in preparedness, is when we're building that relationship with government, with local authorities, with local actors, and then trying to identify some of the key like blockage and challenges that may come up, especially systemically as well, that cannot be resolved during a humanitarian response. So those are like two kind of big things from my side for this round. Thanks, Juliet.
That's great. Thank you very much. Yes, preparedness coming back to that. So if it was these comments as well as ones. So I'm going to open it up to questions. A note for my panelists, I'm not sure we're going to get to a second round.
No, it's fine.
Yes. Things you want to say, like beautifully, seamlessly fold them into your responses to the questions would be my suggestions. So over to you. I'll just keep an eye online as well in case there's any questions there. Yes, Nigel and then Ed.
Great, thanks very much. Nigel Timmins, Associate with Humanitarian Outcomes. We're soon going to be publishing a study we've done on surge capacity. And one of the things that strikes me is the business model at the moment rewards surge. It rewards sort of ex post response, hence signaling being so important, because that's how you can get your money and resources. But in practice, we found the resources available are really quite small. I think it was development initiatives last year said 92% of global humanitarian funding goes to protracted emergencies. So if you think about total ODA, and I don't know what the exact figure is now, but if humanitarian spending is about 15% of global ODA, 8% of that is actually flexible and available for surge response. And then we have all these crises. So we're actually trying to respond to these crises with a very thin sliver of money. And many of the people capacities we rely on in most agencies are actually released for 3 months or even 3 weeks at a time, creating high turnover. And I'm sure we've all the experience of the turmoil there. I think just building on the point about preparedness, there's an interesting link that could be made between preparedness and localization. So that The current business model incentivizes us as operational agencies to ask the question, how do we surge better? If we could switch the question to how do we support existing in-country capacities better, it's a subtle shift, but it might lead to some different questions and perhaps some different solutions.
Great, thank you. Ed?
Yeah, Ed Schenkeberg, Executive Director of HERE and Team Leader of the Interagency Evaluation for Ethiopia. I was a little struck, and I don't know, Glenn, if you already said it, but certainly I think Daniel sort of hinted at it. Let's review the protocols, the scalar protocols that exist, because, and there I probably would agree with you, Daniel, each context is different, exactly what you said. I mean, one size does not fit all. At the same time, I would say, what I also sense there, and that's probably where I would like you, but also others to comment on, I'm not sure you said it, so that's why I'm asking these questions. Let's lower the bar because we cannot meet the standard, i.e. let's change international law because member states do not fulfill or meet their obligations under international law in some situations at the moment. I mean, I'm not sure if you said that, but, you know, I think it's an important point. There are requirements in the standards. I mean, sorry. Those should be met. They're non-negotiable. I mean, why can you? I mean, the issue, let's look at Sudan at the moment, which is an L3. There has been now an EDG mission. But if you look at the protocol, in fact, there should have been an operational peer review taking place. It hasn't. Why? Because of agency politics. Agency politics being in the way. I've heard no one here really talking about it, actually. And so there, I would like a little bit more comments on it, because actually there, I would say, sorry, we should not lower the bar. We should meet what is in the protocol, because that will create some accountability. Happy to hear your reaction.
Great, yes, Laurie.
Thanks. Really super and very interesting to think about. Okay, we had the interagency humanitarian evaluations, we had the system review, pulled it together. Now we have the ODI report as well. You know, the talks have been involving government more from the beginning, and we think about the challenges in the context of Ethiopia and Afghanistan of doing that, given the context. But I'm, you know, one of the reasons for the review, you know, as a learning piece was to inform the protocols. Was to say, okay, the protocols are not working that well. So what needs to change? And I'm not sure that today we've talked about what needs to change. What occurs to me, and one of the things I think is when we think about the accountabilities, it's not only at country level, it's at regional level. You know, when you have an L3 or a system scale up, it's not just about the accountabilities of the humanitarian country team. It's also about the regional level and global level. So did everybody do what they had to do? And I think in that context, two things come to mind in terms of protocols is, do the protocols need to say more on humanitarian diplomacy at different levels, right? At country level, yes, but you can see in the Ethiopia context, it had to go much higher than that and come in from other directions. So does there need to be more emphasis placed on that humanitarian principles? The other thing that strikes me, and we were just looking at the list of the EASC members, you know, UNDSS is absolutely crucial for operationalizing a scale-up. And yet they're not an EASC member. And we don't include them in the interagency humanitarian evaluations either. And yet the way that they work, I mean, can either give us access or not. I mean, there are other reasons why we get access and we don't get access, but they're certainly an important partner. And I just thinking aloud about whether we need to have UNDSS play a more active role in these kind of discussions, maybe even be a member of the EASC. Given their important role in creating the operating conditions for our responses.
Just a super quick note on that. They are a member of the EDG, though. They're not a member of the ISC, but they are of the EDG.
Okay. How can they be a member of the EDG and not a member of the ES?
Slowly.
It's funny.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So lots of comments and questions around protocols and mechanisms. Maybe, Daniel, I can hand to you first.
Yeah. I would definitely agree that, you know, preparedness is always the best way, and we have lived in the humanitarian world with preparedness, so you know, in so in cycles, I would say, you know, we realize it's better to prepare than to react inadequately, which it is always the case. The question is a bit, where do we put your, you know, in which baskets do you put all these eggs? Because you should prepare, in, you know, with early warning. I was doing that for a while for one agency, and we got it mostly wrong. You know, we prepared for situations that in the end didn't blow up massively, and others did without where we were not. So this is a bit the challenge, but in principle, I totally agree. Now, Ed, you're right. I was a bit cautious in saying we should just prolong the period. I just realized it's not happening. And, you know, being a lawyer and being a legal person, it's not the necessarily the written text that counts. It's the intention that counts of the law. So the intention of the protocol is, we are not able to respond adequately. Let's gear up and respond adequately and do everything that it takes to get there. And that's what our marching order should be. And I think this was very nicely reflected in your learning paper. We're not asking for revision of protocols or anything. Can you imagine how complex these things are, and how, again, it will be one model that will not fit everywhere? I think learning from contexts and then allow maybe some flexible applications. Should we have suspended scale up when it was not possible in Ethiopia, so, for example? Should we stick to a 6 month period that we can stagger, or and then afterwards have a signaling period or something? That was, I think, also a proposal or a question. These are models we can use, but you know, we don't live for rigid rules. We live for reality, and I think that's very important. And the reality should not undercut values or rules. That is, you're absolutely right. But you can shape rules and values better by actually working through the reality. I think that's so philosophical, but surely so. And I so much agree with the suggestion to have, you know, my sense is the biggest challenge in gearing up is the deep divisions that we have, and you know, in how we see things, how political forces take us apart, and how we also act differently between humanitarian and development and other actors. These divisions, I think we need to all make a huge effort. Everyone has, you know, comes from a certain point of view, and our role is to bring us together. I think nothing more important in our work, and that defines the, you know, the collective response, and that defines the duration of how able we will be to scale up. I think that would be my deepest wish. Yeah, and that's what we all need to really work on.
Great, thank you. I think Glenn has a comment as well.
I had one thing that I wanted to say, that reflection on what on Nigel's piece there. Something that was in page one of the report, which is the limitation section, and the only, I think, real reticence I had in looking at this in the first place. What we don't have here is a reflection on the relationship between the international scale up, which is very much focused on the agencies and the international response, and the extent to which that drives or substitutes or closes down localization. And I really think that had we had a bigger scope and this been more evaluative, that would have been a critical question that we just did not address. And it's a real, I think it's a real, not necessarily issue. We just didn't look at it. We do acknowledge that at the start, but you know, I think it's worth reflecting on. The only other thing, and I think a few people have mentioned it, I think maybe I was a little bit, because the, you know, it was a short summary. There is a relationship between the scale up and the internal protocols. We talked about it this morning. From the NGO perspective, from the cluster perspective, as long as that scale up exists, it's easier for people to reflect. We didn't speak, but I spoke to some of the other cluster leads. It's easier for them to continue, you know, to justify additional cluster positions and to, yeah.
Great, thank you. I hand over to other panelists who would like to contribute at all.
Can I come in, Julian?
Please.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the reflection. On top of what has been said, particularly just looking there, the surge capacities, like in terms of looking to see the revision of the business model, I would like to really just embark on the level of preparedness, particularly just from the perspective of exploring the in-house capacity in terms of really just embedding localizations in our humanitarian response. I am just fully aware and diligent enough in terms of looking what does mean localization, how we are going to just really adhere the international humanitarian law, the humanitarian principle is something that we can just take into account, particularly just in the conflict emergency response, because people or local partner will also just step aside with one party. So once we have that level of preparedness, we know exactly what kind of action that we also just put in place in terms of having all the required operational capacity. At times when the magnitude of the crisis is coming at the peak, which is going to trigger the scale up, it is an automatic to respond to the required scale. So one of the very practical challenges that we are facing is we were not adequately prepared and we didn't have the minimal operational capacity to respond on the ground. So as we move along as a learning exercise, what I try to just emphasize is like in terms of exploring the local capacity, in terms of also just pre-positioning the surge capacity before we interfacing challenge with the government. After just declaring the system-wide scale-up, the government is always not just perceiving positively. And it puts lots of bureaucratic requirement. Before that, we need to just really see as part of the preparedness strategies that we need to intact in our process. The other thing is we need to just really use the existing system that we have, particularly looking at the northern part of the northern crisis in Ethiopia. There are lots of development actors has been operationalized in the region for decades and decades. Those development agents are evacuating from the region, the humanitarian actor is going to just establish a new system. So we need to just really bring this development and humanitarian agent together so that rather than establishing a new system in that area, better to really just adjust the existing development system from the perspective of responding to the humanitarian crisis. The other point is, we face a difficulty like in terms of anticipating or predicting the conflict situation. Initially, from the very beginning, we call it a Tigray response plan, but the government is quite annoyed being that there is also just a crisis affecting the neighboring regions like Amhara and Afar. So that creates dissatisfaction at the community level, that creates dissatisfaction with the government, which also just affecting the relationship between humanitarian actor and the government. So once we have that comprehensive analysis, we need to just really come across to have a very comprehensive and holistic response and providing the right naming in terms of addressing the perception of the community and the government. The last point that I would like to just reflect is, rather than looking the revision of protocol, yes, of course, that is something that we can just look into it as we go along. But one of the quick wins that we need to just really see is how we are going to just really hold ourselves accountable, particularly those fragmentation, the lack of decisive leadership, and all of that issues is really just relying on the accountability, not looking from the perspective of accountability to affected population, but how we hold as a humanitarian actor, how the HCT will also just imprint that accountability on the gaps that we observe. So that is something that we need to just really embark on it. Over to you, Julia.
Thank you very much. We have 5 minutes remaining. I do want to take a couple more quick questions from the audience if possible, and I'll give Gabriella and Juan the opportunity to respond. In case useful, as thought provokers, on my list of really important issues that came up in the evaluation, the complex realities of a principled response came out very strongly in both IHEs, of course, and protection. The concept of centrality of protection was not adequately realized in either context. So in case that spurs any thoughts also, I wouldn't want us to lose those points. Over to you. Any further questions from the audience? Yes, sure.
I will just take the opportunity to come back on your point, Laurie, is that correct? And add and try to combine it a bit. So I did the review of this get up with Glenn. Was one was about change, and the other one is about acting the reality like it is and giving up on some kind of overarching ambitions or goals. First, the paper did not aim at proposing change, at looking at change. This was not the purpose of it. The purpose was really to unpack what it is and to help the EDG sync with regard to the use of the protocol. And this is an important point I want to highlight after. What we try to do is not to look at the policy on paper, but how it translates into practice. I think you managed that when you presented it very well. One of our key arguments is basically to say to the EDG, the way you're going to approach this protocol, don't look at the paper, look at what it does in practice, acknowledge its reality, and therefore plan accordingly. So basically the question, we know what it does, we know what it doesn't do, is it relevant for this specific context? And here's where I come back to your point, Ed, about acknowledging this reality. Fine, I think it's a very pragmatic, very realistic approach, but this should not lead to the risk of giving up on other ambition. But it doesn't mean that this protocol will be the tool to actually address this issue. The question of access in Ethiopia. Don't think that by changing the protocol, you would have an impact on access in Ethiopia. Those protocols won't work that way. We've tried once from L3 to system-wide scale-up. It basically didn't change the rate of the protocol. So changing the protocol on paper, for me, that's not the main way to go. We might look at it, but this is not where the centrality of the issue is. And therefore, look at other possibility, other engagement to address this issue, that this tool, which is a tool of the system, come with the opportunity, the strengths, but as well the limitation of the system.
Thank you very much. One, I pass.
I thought you were going to go to Gabriella. Oh,
okay. No, because I guess I'm reflecting on it a little bit when we talk about, you know, for change and what change. What I find is that we need, in a way, the right people in the room, the right people in the coordination and the kind of relationship building sort of skills. I think, you know, when you go on like a scale up, a surge, then coming back to this kind of capacity, you know, localization versus preparedness. I find it like in our global cluster meeting every year, people talk about capacity and talk about capacity building. And yet it's something that is being deprioritized by a number of donors who say, this is not life-saving. You know, why keep training? You train and people move on. It's the same for us, it's the same for the government. But the impact, I think, of retaining and engaging in capacity, we had a project in countries in Southern Africa that, you know, means that we walk into the response to IDAI and we have government who've been trained in managing camps. And it's the same in the Philippines, who take over the actually camp management in their countries and the clusters. And we really much, very much go in and in a support role. We walk into the Taal volcano eruptions a couple of years ago,
into an evacuation center. The person was showing me the picture of the training she went to. And in the back of it, the government's running additional trainings for their camp managers. And I feel like we need, I agree that, you know, we need to be heading in that direction. And I think the system, the mechanism is only going to be as strong as the people you have on the ground, in the room. We struggle getting enough of the right people in places. I mean, the number of time that I sit there and go like, we don't have anyone. We want this egg. It's a unicorn these days, and they also have to be French speaking. And so, you know, and that, and I think this is something we need to keep doing, at least from my perspective in our global support team. So that's something we're working for, and that's something we continue to advocate for. And it's also, it's often like a safe space for us to have frank conversation with governments as well when we do these kind of capacity buildings. Like, let's talk about what's stopping your durable solutions in the past. Oh, it's a rental, you know, it could be something benign, like, you know, it's how to register people for rental subsidies. You know, but something's not, we can't do during an emergency response. But can we have that kind of conversations? And this is a place, and I think we don't use enough of those training events as advocacy kind of tools as well. But yeah, I'm gonna stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gabriella, over to you.
Thank you. Just very quickly in response to the colleague who mentioned, are we just simply lowering our standards? And there is a Dutch poet from the 1600s, and there's a line in his poem that goes through my head as a humanitarian every single day. And in English, it's something like between dream and action are some practical objections. And that's our reality, right? Ours is an imperfect world. So I remember 2017, the Somalia response, and the decision we had to make was, are we going to give half the people in need the entire cash assistance that they should get, or are we going to give everybody half the cash assistance that they should get? There's a limit to that. How long is a string? As an EDG, we visited the DRC about a year ago, and I was beyond shocked. And I did come away from that theater thinking, maybe here we need to start saying we just cannot save everybody, and we now are going to have to make choices between yes this one and no this one. It's not something that we as humanitarians are used to doing, right? Our job is to save lives. And but it was really, the DRC response was at the level of, do we give people water or do we give them food or shelter? Because we literally couldn't. And it was just the bottom of the pit. And somebody said to me, you haven't been to Central African Republic yet then, have you? Which is true. So how long is the string? What can we afford? What can't we afford? And, you know, what do we do with the standards? You're absolutely right to ask that question. There is just unfortunately not a solid answer to it. The other question I really wanted to very quickly reflect on is the question on what needs to change. And for me, that is two things. The first thing is to appreciate as humanitarians that we are part of a wider world, that there are other sandboxes that we are not used to playing in, and that those sandboxes have profound implications for us. So as I mentioned before, we have really contorted ourselves, particularly as NGOs, to comply. You know, we hire compliance officers to comply with all the rules and regulations that are being thrown at us. And it's based, frankly, making our job near impossible. Right. So we need to start learning that we're part of a wider ecosystem, and we need to start learning to play in other sandboxes that have different objectives. Why is the system not working for us? Right. That means it's working for somebody else. So we need to be a bit cleverer about that. And then the second thing on what needs to change is within our own sandbox. And that is appreciating that even though, Danielle, you're absolutely right, there are some actors that don't have money and that do rely on donor funding in order to respond. However, I would challenge a little bit by saying we all have agency. We all have agency. We all have some decision-making within our grasps, especially as at the level of the EDG, to say, I am actually going to now reprioritize that's our job as humanitarians, right? We're not development actors. So even though we have committed resources prior, the world has changed, new priorities have emerged. I need to reprioritize. And that means people, that means funding allocated, etc. If our total pie doesn't change, we do have agency within our own organizations and as a collective to relook at the priorities as the world throws new challenges at us. And that is what I think needs to change. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes, excellent comments and finish on. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to everybody. I'm sorry, we've gone over by a few minutes. But I think it's given me a lot to think about, is for sure. How the intention behind a mechanism, how it then gets used, and the practical complex realities of its application. And I was also struck very much about Gabriella's earlier comments about the triangle of accountabilities, and that we can't only focus on our little bit of it, but actually the interrelationships that need to all work in order for us to be able to deliver collectively and effectively. Thank you very much, everybody, for your time. We have taken some photos. If you don't want to be featured in any photos, please come and let me know. Otherwise, you may see yourself on our socials, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you very much.